You've been here the last couple of weeks. John McCarty has carried us through a detailed exposition of the book of Nahum. All I could think of was Naomi. I knew that wasn't right. Of Nahum. And today we're going to do another short Old Testament minor prophet, the book of Obadiah. In fact, Obadiah is the shortest book in the Old Testament. You'll see from the outline something a little different. For me, it's three pages instead of one. That doesn't sound good right off the bat. I think we're going to be moving fast to try to get through all of this without being terribly long-winded. So you listen fast, and I'll talk fast, and we'll make it. Bad blood, name of the sermon. Tell me what you think of when you read that sermon title, those two words. What did you say, Stephen? Bad history. Somebody else said something. What? Feud. A feud. Lori, did you say something? Okay, family feuds. Rivalries. Okay. Rock and roll song from the 70s. Somebody give her her pills or something. Okay, blood. That gives you the idea that it's relatives, someone kin to you, blood kin to you. Bad means something that's not good. Something that's wrong with this blood. Bad blood. This morning we're going to go through just a background for Obadiah's oracle, or Obadiah's prophecy. And we're not going to cover anything in the book. We're going to read it, the text toward the end of the book of Obadiah. But I want to ask you something. How many of you could spare 3 minutes tomorrow? See your hand. Okay, 3 minutes. That's what I figured. It takes 3 minutes to read through the book of Obadiah aloud. I want to challenge you to take 3 minutes, maybe 6 minutes, maybe 9 minutes every day this week and read through this book before next week. And it will enhance your understanding of the message next week, I can assure you. Obadiah. You see on the outline, I've got some dates there. And these dates, I'm obviously not certain of these dates. These are dates that are pretty much agreed on by scholars of when some of these things occur. They may be off 6 months. They may be off 20 years. I'm not sure. It may be off 100 years. I'm not sure. But also go through some of these things, because this is the background that leads up to Obadiah's oracle. In the book of Genesis, chapter 25, and I'll be reading a few verses here and there. If you want to kind of flip over there, you can find them pretty quick as they get there. But you remember Abraham had a son, two sons, at least two sons. One Ishmael, first, that was not the promised son, or at least not the son with whom the promise would go through. And then he had Isaac. Isaac married, and Isaac had two sons. Isaac had two sons. They were twins. And you remember the count of Rebekah, Isaac's wife, was barren. She had trouble having children, and she conceived. And during her pregnancy, the scripture says that there was a struggle in her womb, and at least something was going on. And this was her first pregnancy, so you know she's not that versed on what to expect, I wouldn't think, of in a pregnancy. Not like she had already had 10 kids or something. But there's something just wasn't right. And she inquired of God and said, Lord, what is going on here? And we see in Genesis chapter 25 and verse 23, God tells her these words. Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So we see this first information that gives us some insight as to what is to come from this pregnancy and from this childbirth. She finds out that she's going to have twins. And she finds out that the relationship that's going to develop between those two children. Now, whether or not Rebecca shares what she has learned with her husband Isaac, I don't know. I would think, if I were had to guess, I would imagine that she did. It would seem the natural thing to do. But I just don't know. But let's assume that she did. So Isaac has this piece of information in his mind. It's there. She gives birth to the twins. The first one comes out. It gives birth to the first one. It says he is ruddy and hairy and kind of scruffy looking. All right, perhaps. And they named him Esau. Esau does not mean red. Esau means hairy. It means handling, rough handling. All right? Where we get the word red is from the word Edom, which we will see. Edom is another name that Esau is called, and that word means red. If you get had the idea in your mind that Esau meant red, doesn't. Edom means red. So he is born, and then shortly behind him comes the other child, and he has a hold of Esau's heel. And so they named him Jacob. The word Jacob means catching by the heel. Okay, some of your Bibles may use the word supplanter. If you look up the word supplant in the dictionary, the root of that word comes from words meaning to catch by the heel. In other words, to trip up. Something that comes up in your path and you stumble over it. Something that impedes your progress. Most of us in school have had the experience of going down the aisle of the desk and some smart aleck sticks their foot out and impedes your progress. All right, he is a supplanter. He is a Jacob. So the boys are named Esau and Jacob. Now, just from what we've seen so far, you can see potential for bad blood. One is going to serve the other. In fact, the older will serve the younger, God told her. And that is out of the ordinary, at least from the standpoint that the older would typically receive the birthright and the privileges and responsibilities that come with being the oldest and having the birthright. But it's not going to be that way. We see the idea of the younger one being someone who trips up the older one. So you see this potential for bad blood. Surely Rebecca has these thoughts in her mind as she looks at her newborn children. If she shared it with Isaac, surely Isaac, it crosses his mind during this time, and perhaps off and on for years to come. 40 years pass. The boys obviously are grown. They are as different as daylight and dark. Esau is an outdoorsman, skilled in hunting. He likes anything that's outside. Jacob, notice my word here, it was a complete man. Your text may say he was a mild man. Some versions say he was a plain man. Some say he was a gentle man. The Hebrew word there that's translated in those ways means complete. And it has to do with an all-around picture of this man's personality, of his character. right? And what I'm fixing to tell you now is some assumptions and suppositions on my part. The text doesn't tell us this. But it seems to me that Jacob, being described that way, was a well-rounded guy. He was a guy that thought through things that he did before that he did them. He was well-educated. He was well-versed. He was morally respected by those around him that knew him. And contrasting this with Esau, Esau seems to be a person who could make decisions very quickly. He would make decisions very quickly. And most often those decisions were made in order to satisfy his own preferences, his own likes, the things that he cared about to please himself. Isaac is partial to Esau. Rebecca is partial to Jacob. Again, we see more potential for bad blood. There comes a point when they're about 40 years old that Esau has been out hunting or out doing something. And he comes back and he's tired and he's weary and he is hungry. And Jacob has been cooking. And Jacob has cooked a pot of stew or a pot of something that smells really good. And Esau is hungry. And Esau, being an impulsive person, wants some of Jacob's food. And unknown to the reason being unknown to me and to us, for some reason Jacob is not willing to just freely give him the food. Jacob says, "I'll trade it to you for your birthright." Now that seems ridiculous. It seems ridiculous that Jacob would make such an offer. It seems even more ridiculous that Esau would accept it. But he does. He says, "What good is my life to me? I'm about to die of hunger." Was Esau in such bad shape when he crawled in the door that he's about to die if he doesn't get one last pot of soup? I mean, he talks like that. He speaks like that. But we see after he eats it, he gets up and walks out and goes on his way. But this tells us something about Esau. In fact, the Bible tells us what it tells us about Esau. It says thus at the last verse of chapter 25, Esau despised his birthright. It tells us something about Esau. He is a person who has no sense of responsibility. As a person who has no sense of moral responsibility, he is only out for himself. It seems from this account and everything else you'll see about Esau practically throughout, we're going to look at real quickly, he has no capacity for making morally responsible decisions. They are foreign to him. He has no regard for these things. And so he trades away his birthright for a little of nothing. Notice this text says in verse 34, 25-34, Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Notice what it says, and then he ate and drank, arose, and went his way. Seemingly with no remorse, with no second thoughts, it meant nothing to him. He lived only for the moment. Now, if you haven't already, you're fixing to. If you haven't already thought of someone you know who fits this bill, you can now. There are plenty of people in this world. They may be successful in business, They may be a good provider. They bring home and take care of their family. But there is absolutely no regard for God at all. And they can trade away a spiritual heritage at the drop of a hat and never look back. That's Esau. And again, we see the potential for bad blood. I wonder at this point what Jacob knows about the vision that Rebekah had when she was pregnant. Why is Jacob interested in this birthright? It makes me wonder if somewhere along the line, Rebekah hasn't told him. Maybe not. I don't know. But for some reason, it's on Jacob's mind to try to weasel this out of his brother Esau. We don't know that that happened. We don't know if Isaac knows about it. I suspect if Isaac knew about Rebekah's vision from God, that the older would serve the younger, I suspect that Isaac kind of blows it off. Because Isaac is the one who will bestow that blessing. And Isaac is the one, he might would tell himself after the 40 years have gone by and it's obvious he is favoring Esau, Isaac is not one to give the birthright to Jacob. And it's probable that Isaac is having the thought, I'm the one in control of who gets that. Regardless of what her vision she thinks she had, I can take care of this. So it doesn't bother him. Time goes on. Esau takes two Hittite women as wives. We see from just a few verses, I'm going to turn the volume down on my phone while I'm thinking about it. We see from just a couple of verses there that he marries these women. It doesn't tell us that he did it hastily or impulsively, but you can read between the lines and kind of come to that conclusion because they give his parents grief. It grieves his parents that he has done this. Again, seemingly with no thought, with not looking ahead down the road, with no worry about or no concern about their spiritual heritage or their spiritual background, just does it. So he marries these women. Isaac is getting old, and he's getting blind. In fact, he's practically blind, I would assume. And Isaac thinks he's about to die. He's not. But he thinks he is. He's going to live another 80 years. But at this moment, he's 100 years old. He thinks he's about to die. And so he makes plans to begin this transfer of the birthright from him to Esau. And you know the story. Esau, he has Esau go out and catch some game that he likes and prepare it like he likes it. And Rebekah hears what's going on there, and while he's gone, she works with Jacob and connives and organizes things where they deceive Isaac into giving Jacob the blessing. And we know the story of how that happened. He blesses Jacob, Jacob leaves. Esau comes in a little bit later and brings the food to his father and has his father to eat it, and Isaac is terrified. Isaac is horrified because he realizes, I have messed up. This is Esau, and I have already given the blessing, the birthright, to somebody else. And by this time, he figures out, I'm sure, that it was Jacob. I want us to read a little bit of this account. This will be in chapter 27. Verse 34. When Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceedingly great and bitter cry. Notice the descriptive words. And said to his father, bless me also. Me also, oh my father. Can you visualize the anguish that is in his soul at this point? Isaac says, your brother has came with deceit and taken away your blessing. Esau, notice what he says in verse 36. Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now look, he's taken away my blessing. Notice something about Esau. He's a victim. Jacob has taken away his birthright. No, Jacob didn't take away his birthright. He gave it away for a pot of soup. But the blame goes to Jacob for deceiving him. Esau is hurt. He is grieving. He is regretful. He is filled with remorse. But he turns his frustration and his anger not upon his own stupidity, but upon someone else. The blame does not lie at his feet, but to someone else, being Jacob. He says, have you not reserved a blessing for me? In verse 37, Isaac says, indeed, I have made him your master, and all his brethren I have given to him as servants. With grain and wine I have sustained him. What shall I now do to you? Esau says, have you not only one blessing for me? Can you not just give me something? Bless me in some way? Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Now, I want us to look at the two blessings. You see in verses 27 to 29, the blessing that Isaac gives to Jacob. Verse 27, he says, surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you. You can see this is the passing down of the everlasting blessing and covenant that God has made with Abraham, with Isaac, and now with Jacob. Compare that to what Isaac does, blessing he does give Esau in verses 39 and 40. He tells Esau, behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth. That doesn't sound bad, does it? And of the dew of heaven from above, by your sword you shall live. The indication of toil, the indication of hardness. Things are not going to come easy. And you shall serve your brother. It shall come to pass when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck. So here Isaac tells Esau, you'll serve your brother and it will be a burdensome task. It will be a weight around your neck that you will live with. And the day will come when you will break it off. You will break free from that. Bad blood. We continue to see this aspect of what is going to happen. Esau is angry. Esau is directing the blame and placing all the blame on Jacob. And he makes a vow to himself that when my father dies, I'll kill him. I will kill my brother. Somehow, and I don't know how long a time has passed, it doesn't have to be a day or two, it could be several years, but Rebekah gets wind of his intentions. Now, I say it can be several years because he's not going to carry it out until Isaac dies, and Isaac is not dead. But at some point afterwards, Rebecca hears of his intentions and she decides to get Jacob out of there. And so she talks to Jacob and then she talks to Isaac. And Isaac is okay with that. Isaac goes along with that. Isaac does what he has to do to send Jacob on his way. What appears to be in a proper manner. He tells Jacob, when you go, don't marry women, the Canaanite women. Go, and we're going to send you to my first cousin's house, or actually it's, I think it's a first cousin in one way and a brother in another, and you will marry someone from there. But don't marry any of these Canaanite women around here. So they send him away. Esau heard that. And Esau puts two and two together. My parents are not pleased with my wives. So Esau tries to fix it. He goes and finds him two more wives from his uncle Ishmael's half-uncle. They're his daughters, or at least one of them is his daughter. And he marries them, trying to gain favor, trying to please his parents, trying to please his father. But what's missing? What's missing is the root or the foundation of all this. Esau again just does something. He does something. And on your outline, I've worded it this way. It's a half-baked decision from Esau. On the spur of the moment, attempting to get a blessing from his parents, but ignoring the worship and devotion to God, which undergirds and gives value to such a blessing. A lot of times people try to do what really is right, but their reasons for doing it are all wrong. And that reason for doing something is vital to making it right. And Esau, again, is void of that concept. Esau, again, does not have those thoughts. Esau again does not think that way. Well, Jacob's gone. Jacob takes off. He goes to Laban. You remember that? You remember the account? We're not going to go through all of that, but he marries. He's there for 40 or 50 years, it seems. He marries. You know the story of serving for 7 years for this one and serving 7 years for that one. And he's married and he's profitable. He is prosperous. You can read the account. Amazing way that God prospered his herds. And there came a point where Jacob was so prosperous that there began to be some jealousy between him and his wife's brothers or their other family members. And so there's this conflict that goes on, and Jacob decides that the best thing I can do is go back home. Take my wives, my children, and head back home. So he does that. He tells Laban what he's, or Laban finds out what he's going to do. And Jacob is headed back home. On his way, somewhere along the line, he thinks of Esau. What happens if I see Esau? Esau is vowed to kill me. I don't know if he knows if his father's still alive or not. He is, but I don't know if he knows that or not. But he knows there's potential trouble when I get back and see Esau. So he sends some scouts, you might say, ahead to try to check out the matter and to let Esau know that he's coming. And they come back with the message, yeah, Esau knows, and he's headed this way with 400 men. Now, what do you think that means? It doesn't sound good, does it? So Jacob cries out to God. And Jacob's cry to God tells us something about his heart. And we're not going to read it, but I've got the references there. Genesis 32, 9 to 12, two different occasions, close together, and verses 24 to 32. You read those and feel his heart, and it will show you easily, I think, the contrast between Jacob and Esau. Sure, Jacob did some wrong things, and from the way we look at things. And I'm not saying that everything he did was right, but it gives to me a picture of Jacob's heart and his devotion to God, his view of God, his even thinking of God that seems to be devoid in Esau. Jacob sends a series of servants to meet Esau, not right all together, but spaced out, where that one of them gets to Esau and presents him with some gifts, and then maybe a day later, or 2 days later, or a week later, I don't know, here comes another one and gives him some gifts, and then another, and then another, and he's trying to appease Esau. He's trying to buy Esau's favor. And finally they meet face to face, and Jacob is pleasantly surprised. And he is pleased because Esau receives him warmly. They embrace. Esau offers to help him, and they continue on their way back to their land. Now that seems like things have the hatchet's been buried, everything is A-okay, right? But it's not. And there's not many things very out in front for us to see that they're not. There's not any incidents that are recorded for us that show us things are not. But let's see what happens. At some point, the dad dies, Isaac dies, and a phrase there that gives me a good feeling about it says, Jacob and Esau buried their father. That sounds good. Sounds like they're on the same page. Sounds like they are grieving together for the loss of their dad. Somewhere in there, Esau takes all of his stuff, and he moves. And do you have that map, Kylie? After I downloaded this image, I couldn't see the words when I first did it, but it's a Spanish version, I think, well, no, this one's not. Most of them I saw were Spanish. This one's, unless Kylie changed it all to English, I don't know, but anyway, there were Spanish words, but the same thing as Spanish. But you can see down here at the bottom, Edom. Can you see that? That is where Esau goes. They have been a little to the northwest. Hebron, you see the word Judah? Somewhere in that area is where they were raised. And when Jacob comes back, they are there. And they're both of them are successful. They have a huge amount of livestock. There's just not enough usable land for both of them to stay together. And so Esau takes initiative and leaves. And he heads southeast to what is labeled on the map Edom. Notice that it's Esau that leaves. Now, I don't know, this doesn't mean a whole lot. But it, again, is predictable that of the two brothers, Esau would be the one that would tear his roots away and leave. So he goes to Edom. Now his descendants stay there. And I wanted to show you this interesting verse here, if I can find it. You look at chapter 36, verse 1. It says, now this is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom. E-D-O-M. You go on down to verse 8. So Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. Okay, now I don't know, there's three times there. The very last verse in chapter 36, verse 43, last phrase, Esau was the father of the Edomites. Now, three times in that chapter, it's pointed out to us that Esau and Edom are one and the same, or at least they're the name that's going to refer to Esau's descendants from now on is Edomites, The land is called Edom. So, you won't hear much more about Esau, but you'll hear a lot more about Edom or the Edomites. Now then, Jacob stays in the land where they're at. Jacob is the one that is living in the land that God promised to Abraham's descendants. That promise was passed down through Isaac. It was passed on down to Jacob. So they are there. We're going to jump ahead. You know the story of how that the children of Israel ended up going to Egypt. And they're there because of the famine. They're there for hundreds of years. And then on their return, they're on their way back. And I'm just going to point out a few verses here and there. On their way back, they sing this song. They have come across the Red Sea. The Red Sea has miraculously opened up. They have crossed over, and the Red Sea has miraculously closed back in and drowned the Egyptians. And they sing this song. It's a long song, and it's in Exodus chapter 15. But one of the phrases in that song is this: the chiefs of Edom will be dismayed. And the idea that there's, you can read the whole song and see that God's going to lead us to the promised land, and the Moabites are going to be terrified of us. The chiefs of Edom will be dismayed because they see us coming. Now, why is this? Why is this that they, part of their song is that their brothers, their relatives, are one of the people who is going to be afraid of them. One of the people that they appear that they're going to push away, to drive out, to defeat, to overcome. It appears that way from their song. So it looks like that even then, in the Israelites' mind, there's bad blood. There is something there that has never been really resolved. They go on their way. At some point, God tells Moses, and this is then reviewed for us in Deuteronomy chapter 2. God tells Moses, on your way back, when you come to Edom, be careful. Be careful. These are your brothers. Make sure that if you damage any of their crops on your way through, you pay for it. Make sure if you drink any of their water, you buy it from them. Because I have given them their land. Make sure you treat them right. Now, that's interesting. On their way, they come to Edom. And before they get on the Edomites' territory, they send word ahead saying, we are your brothers, come out of Egypt. They acknowledge this relationship with the Edomites. And we're asking for permission to go across your land, to go on the highway, to go across your land to get to where we're going. We'll pay you for whatever we damage or we do. The Edomites said no. No way. You go somewhere else. Don't come across our land. Why is that? I don't know. But for some reason, there's bad blood between the Edomites and the Israelites. So they back up and they go way around, and it caused them, you can read on in the Numbers, Deuteronomy, hardship because of the extra time and the terrain, the path they had to take was rough on them. The Israelites get to Egypt, get settled, get all divided up, and you'll see here that the tribe of Judah, their land borders that of Edom. So there are neighbors, there are bordering countries with this uneasiness between the two. That uneasiness exist for hundreds of years. There comes a point where King Saul of the Israelites had some skirmishes and some battles and some fighting going on between the Israelites and the Edomites under King Saul. I don't know that he ever defeats them and overtakes their territory, but what he doesn't accomplish, King David does. David defeats them. David puts Gerith's military outpost in the country of Edom. Later on, when Solomon becomes king, he controls all the land from, that's gone, ain't it? From Edom, you can't see it on here, but on straight on down, you get to the Red Sea. All that land is Edomites' land, and Solomon controls the access all the way to the Red Sea for trade purposes. That's, he has a fleet of ships that are put there. Years later, a few years later after that, in the reign of probably about 150 years later, in the reign of Jehoram, the Edomites fulfill the prophecy that Isaac told Esau. The day will come when you will grow restless and weary of the Israelite, your brother's yoke about you, and you'll throw it off your neck. During the reign of Jehoram, the Edomites rebelled and threw out the Israelites and ruled their own country again. So that was fulfilled at that time. A few years later, King Amaziah, 50 years later, turns the tables again. So there begins this, for hundreds of years, this battle, this bickering, this fighting, this killing back and forth between the Israelites and the Edomites. When the Babylonians defeat Judah and they relocate all of the people out of Judah and carry them off to Babylon. You remember some of those people, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, some of these people carried off. When Babylon was taking over Judah and Jerusalem, the Edomites helped them. The Edomites saw an opportunity and joyfully helped the Babylonians take the Israelites out of the land, and they took over some of the land. They just stayed there. They just kind of moved in since the Israelites were gone out. Psalm 137 reads this. I want you to read this with us. So if you would, turn to Psalm 137. It's a short psalm. You're familiar with part of it, I know. Psalm 137, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. That sound familiar? We hung our harps upon the willows in the midst of it. For there those who carried us away captive asked of us a song. Those who plundered us requested mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. So they're in Babylonia in captivity, and their captors are mocking them. Give us your harps, sing us one of your songs. Well, who likes to sing a song when they're sad? You know, that wasn't something they wanted to do, but they were made to do it. Verse 4, how shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. And notice verse 7. Remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it to its very foundation, or raise it means to destroy it, to tear it apart. So as the Babylonians were tearing apart Jerusalem, the Edomites were on the sidelines cheering them on. Tear it down. Tear it down all the way to its foundation. O daughter of Babylon, who are to be destroyed, happy the one who repays you as you have served us. Happy the one who takes and dashes your little ones against the rock. So we see here the psalmist in Psalm 137 recounts the time when Jerusalem was hauled off by the Babylonians and the Edomites or cheering them on. It is probably during this time that Obadiah writes this scathing oracle against the Edomites. So let's read Obadiah. If I can find it. Obadiah, 21 verses. We're going to read it today, and next week we'll go through it. The vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations, saying, Arise and let us rise up against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You shall be greatly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you. You who dwell in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, you who say in your heart, Who will bring me down to the ground? Though you ascend as high as the eagle, and though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the Lord. If thieves had come to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you will be cut off. Would they not have stolen till they had enough? If grape gatherers had come to you, would they not have left some gleanings? Oh, how Esau shall be searched out, how his hidden treasures shall be sought after. All the men in your confederacy shall force you to the border. The men at peace with you shall deceive you and prevail against you. Those who eat your bread shall lay a trap for you. No one is aware of it. Will I not in that day, says the Lord, even destroy the wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountains of Esau? Tell your mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed. Or then your mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed. To the end that everyone from the mountains of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. For violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. In the day that you stood on the other side, in the day that strangers carried captive his forces, when foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem. See, that gives you the count of Babylonians. Even you were as one of them. But you should not have gazed on the day of your brother in the day of his captivity. Nor should you have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. Nor should you have spoken proudly in the day of distress. You should not have entered the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Indeed, you should not have gazed on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. You should not have stood at the crossroads to cut off those among them who escaped, nor should you have delivered up those among them who remained in the day of distress. For the day of the Lord upon all the nations is near. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your reprisal shall return upon your own head. For as you drank of my holy mountain, on my holy mountain, so shall the nations drink continually. Yes, they shall drink and swallow. They shall be as though they had never been. But on Mount Zion there shall be deliverance. There shall be holiness. The house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. But the house of Esau shall be stubble. They shall kindle them and devour them, and no survivor shall remain of the house of Esau. For the Lord has spoken. The south shall possess the mountains of Esau. The lowland shall possess Philistia. They shall possess the fields of Ephraim and the fields of Samaria. Jacob shall possess Gilead. And the captives of his host of the children of Israel shall possess the land of the Canaanites. As far as Zarephath, the captives of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad shall possess the cities of the south. Then saviors shall come to Mount Zion to judge the mountains of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. We'll look at that in a little detail next week. I'm going to leave you just with a couple of thoughts that you see on your outline. Bad blood can last a long time. Not always, but it can. It can last for hundreds and hundreds of years, where the people who are present in the conflict don't have a clue about why they despise another group of people. This started with two brothers. Two brothers. How could things go so far south? How could things be so bad between two brothers that hundreds of their descendants still are fighting and angry and filled with hate and despise one another. I want to give you some thoughts. Through the lives of Jacob and Esau, from their birth to their death, here's a thought. God is in control. God knew what was going on. God had said, the elder will serve the younger. I may not particularly like how God brought that about, but God didn't ask me. God sometimes will use the unrighteous behavior of unrighteous men to accomplish his righteous decrees. Jacob was not a shining angel in every way. I would not have thought God would have fulfilled that promise that the older would serve the younger. I would not have thought God would have brought that to pass by Jacob selling and obtaining it with a pot of soup. But he did. I would not have thought God would have brought that to pass by Jacob deceiving his blind daddy into blessing him. But he did. God is free to use whatever means he wants to use to accomplish whatever good he wants to accomplish. The greatest good the world has ever seen, the crucifixion and the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, was done by angry men. Carried out God's redeeming plan. 1 Corinthians tells us if they had known what they were doing, they would not have done it. Satan was filled with glee, I'm sure, as Jesus was nailed to the cross. If he had known the salvation it had brought, would bring, surely he would not have done it. God uses, can use. I would not have wrote the story that way. I would have made Jacob a shining angel. But he wasn't. But God used it to accomplish what he means. And the last thing is this: God's rule extends far beyond his chosen people. I can remember years ago, I was in a group of men somewhere discussing the Ten Commandments. And the thought was expressed that the Ten Commandments were not just for Israel. I can remember the puzzled look on this one guy's face as he considered the idea that God's moral law, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not covet, was not just for his chosen group of people. God's moral law extends to every person who has ever lived. They may not be an Israelite. They may not be chosen by God, but they are still responsible to live morally according to the law that God writes on their conscience in their heart. And that includes the Edomites. God uses his prophet, his people, to deliver a message of judgment to an outside pagan nation. We saw it last week with Nahum and the Ninevites. We see it now with Obadiah and Edom. God reigns everywhere. Let's pray.